Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite media. I'm one of your hosts, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks at Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm okay. It's just been an interesting week, all told.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we live in interesting times is sort of a common thing now.
It's gotten beyond interesting and into concerning, or maybe even nightmarish. I'm not sure.
What was it, the old saying goes, may you live in uneventful times?
No, it's the other way around. I think it is the interesting times bit. Like, yeah. It's a curse. You curse somebody and say, may you live in interesting times. Yeah.
All right. Well, we are always living in interesting times, and we're going to kick it off this week. Now, we were going to do some long form storytelling stuff, which we probably will still do in the future. But we're going to take a detour today, and we're going to go through some of the questions that you, our listeners, sent in to us. So if you have questions for this or any of our podcasts, be sure to send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. If you have a Patreon subscription with us, which again, we thank you because that helps us keep going here. You can go ahead and submit those questions to our Patreon queue and podcast questions, in Discord channel. Because, well, we tend to look there first to give our Patreon supporters a little bit of a way of saying thanks by giving you first billing. And if you can't do that and you don't want to send us an email, there is a Q and podcast questions channel on the Discord for everybody else. And we do look there as well. Just, again, specify the show that it's for. We have a lot of them now. There's a lot of shows. All right. So this one is going to go from Biafari, Blightblade of Wildhammer. I was thinking about changes my many alts will have due to their time in the Shadowlands. And it got me wondering, how is this experience going to impact the eternal hunger that all Death Knights are supposed to feel? Legacy Death Knights are told by Instructor Resuvius that the endless hunger will soon take hold of you, Death Knight. When it does, you will feel pain immeasurable. There's only one remedy for the suffering. The hunger must be sated. Is it the same as the presence that Morgraine and the other four horsemen felt disappear during the We Ride Forth short story? Was it domination magic and a connection to the Maw that was causing all the pain for the DKs? And now that the conduit is broken, they no longer need to inflict pain on others to keep their own at bay. Most importantly, does this mean I can have a DK that's not a total edgelord?
Well, quite frankly, if you have a DK who's a total edgelord, that's on you. You could always play them like they weren't total edgelords. Not everybody deals with chronic pain the same way.
But to be fair, my Death Knight was an edgelord. I just shopped at Hot Topic a lot.
Yeah, my Death Knight was actually cheerful. Actually much happier than they were when they were alive. But regardless, this is a big unit we don't know, because it hasn't been, strictly speaking, stated one way or the other. It's quite possible that Death Knights feel that pain not because of domination magic or the presence that you mentioned from the short story, but simply because they are dead but not done moving. They are a violation of the natural order. That's just a fact. If you're undead of any kind, be you a Forsaken, be you a Scourge, be you a Death Knight, you are a violation of the natural order. This is not how your life is supposed to work. Life and death aren't supposed to cross like this. You're not supposed to have a dead thing wandering around inside the land of the living. Just like you're not supposed to have a living thing wandering around the land of the dead. Now, we didn't get any kind of weird vampiric hunger while we were in the Shadowlands, but that would, you know, kind of track, because it's not like the Shadowlands are doing anything to keep you alive. If anything, we should have probably have been getting sick, you know, because everything around us is dead and it's death itself and we're constantly hanging around there. But, you know, I understand that they didn't want to have to deal with that from a storytelling perspective. Yeah, but there's no answer to your question. There's speculation.
I was going to say, I have speculation.
Yeah, there's tons of speculation. If you'd like some speculation, Joe and I have that for you. I'm going to let Joe do his, and then I'll do mine if mine isn't the same. We have about a 40% chance that we probably came up with the same thing from different directions, so I'm going to let him go.
So you mentioned that in the short story, when they talk about the We Ride Forth, and they felt that presence sort of lessen, and the fact that we learned that the Helm of Domination ties back to the Jailer, it feels like the Helm of Domination, even without that name, is definitely something that would exert a certain amount of influence or pre-programming through it. And we know that there's a couple factors here, so bear with me here while I get to the apex here. What Matt said about the undead always, you know, having sort of that, I don't want to say wrongness to them, but feeling pain or feeling something akin to that, we know that's true, right? We've talked to Liliana Voss about that. We've talked to a bunch of the other undead and forsaken that we've interacted with talk about, you know, feeling that pain. Look at the Shadows Rising book, where we talk about, or where they show the, I can never remember her name, the warden that was raised, but she's always angry. And we talked before about how, like, being forsaken raises your, like, a certain emotion or a certain aspect of your personality to kind of be bigger or sort of, like, amplify it, whether that's pain or anger or anguish or whatever the case is. They never seem to be good qualities. They always seem to be something that is negative. Then you look at the Death Knights, there is a possibility that hunger wasn't necessarily natural hunger, but it was... I'm going to compare this to Warhammer 40K because it's probably the best comparison I can give. There's a group of Marines that they were called the Hounds of War at first, then they're called the World Eaters, and they're basically their Primarch Angron decided to shove weird mechanical nails into their head that the only way that it would relieve the pressure that it would be of them drilling into their brain, this is very grimdark, I apologize, would be to kill. Right. That was the release for it. That's how it was programmed to do. It's entirely possible that what you're getting at here with the Helm of Domination is true, right? Is not only did they already have the negative traits of being undead, whether it was hubris or unerring sense of duty, which can be a negative. Let's, you know, look at Whitemane or some weird, I don't want to say weird psychosis, but like whatever personality flaws amped up, now associate that with they are constantly feeling pain unless they do something to lessen it. And they're basically being turned into, whether consciously or subconsciously, by the Helm of Domination, or in this case, the Lich King, to torturers and essentially devils to lessen that. It's just like a perfect storm, right? They don't have the humanity to fight back against it completely. And whatever's there, whether it's the domination magic or literally part of the Jailer's plan to make these essentially warriors or bodyguards want to do that. Because we also see this reflected in the Sanctum of Domination. We see that's what the torturers are doing. That's what the things he created are doing. And they look an awful lot like Death Knight armor that's been infused with anima. Like, that's what they do. That's the entire purpose of it. So there is a possibility that when they felt that presence lift, it was the Jailer's influence through the Helm lessening. Now, what that means now that the Helm's been reforged into the Crown of Wills, no idea. But there is a possibility therein. And I think that might be some truth in there, maybe. But again, it's all speculation because we don't know. Okay, Matt, your turn.
Basically, one of the things I've been thinking about ever since we found out that the Jailer didn't create domination magic or the Helm of Domination, that it was based on ideas from the Primus over in Maldraxxus.
Yeah, rune magic, right?
It's like, look at what Yeah, but specifically the domination magic. That was what they used to trap the jailer. The jailer himself was under the effects of domination magic. What does that mean? What does domination magic actually do? Like, we've never heard a full explanation of what this stuff actually does. I can tell you what fell magic does. I can tell you what arcane magic does, what divine magic does, what the primal energies that the natures, like, you know, shaman and druids draw upon. We know what that does. We don't know what domination magic does. We know that it's involving with runes. We know that it's a kind of subset of rune magic. We know that the domination, the Helm of Domination and Frostmourne were both made by it. So it's similar to rune blades and rune items, but it's specific. What is it doing? How does it work? How was the jailer bound? Was the jailer bound in the same way that the Death Knights are? Like, here's the thing to think about. Are the Eternal Ones part of the Realm of Death? Just because they seem to be in charge of it doesn't mean they're actually part of it. Because they can die and
someone
else...
Or are they
just
bound there?
What? They can stop doing their job for whatever reason, and you can just make somebody else do it. You can take a piece out of the jailer and make that piece into the Arbiter. You can actually take the Arbiter part of him out and make it its own thing. Or you can give it to somebody else, like with Pelagos. There's an aspect to the Shadowlands and to the nature of the things that come from there that feels like we're not getting the full story of it. And the Primus for me is the big, why did he have this? Like, why did he have a means to bind the jailer? Did he have that going beforehand, or did he come up with it on the spot? If he came up with that on the spot, that's up there with Gul'dan just kind of coming up with the idea of Death Knights out of saving his own butt. Like, he was like, okay, we need to trap him. Sure, I got something. You know, I've seen lots of people talk about the idea that maybe the Primus is the bad guy of this whole thing. Maybe the Primus is, like, secretly behind everything. But for a moment, let's not focus on that. Let's focus on Maldraxxus itself. Because each realm is a reflection of its creator, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they all kind of created these realms. Like, before the Winter Queen showed up, Ardenweald wasn't anything. Denathrius literally says, I am Revendreth. You know, these realms are inexorably tied to the being that shaped them. The Archon's realm is very much what you would expect from the Archon. So Maldraxxus is essentially a giant festering corpse that the people, the beings on it, are literally drawing stuff out of it. You see them do this. They make their armors and weapons out of the material of this enormous festering corpse that they're standing on. And domination magic was created by the guy who thought that was great. That's literally, it's like a metaphor for conquest itself, because you literally kill things and, you know, rule on top of their corpses. That's what conquest is. And in the realm of Maldraxxus, conquest is eternal. It's what they are doing all the time. When they're not busy fighting something attacking the Shadowlands, they're fighting each other. So what is domination magic all about? Is it about literally that, about victory, about dominating your opponent, about conquering them? Like, what's going on with it? And what does it do to Death Knights? If it is the reason Death Knights feel that pain, why is it the reason they feel that pain? Is that to motivate them to go forth and dominate something? Like, is that what they're doing to address the pain? Is it not just hurting other people, but by using your power, displaying some kind of domination or dominance over something else? Like, there's, I don't know that I think the pain is because of domination magic. I think that it might not be. But if it is, I think it's because domination magic has not really been explained or explored. Like, we don't know what this is actually doing or what it's really for. And I don't think that, I think it's interesting that when he reforged it, the Primus made it into this, like, indomitable helm. What is the name of it now?
The Crown of Wills.
The Crown of Wills?
Or Helm of Wills, something like that.
That seems like will is the opposite of domination magic. Will is the thing that the domination magic dominates. It's the thing that opposes it.
Removal of free will, which would...
Not to get too Green Lantern-y here, but, you know, we know that in the Green Lantern mythos, will is the power that fuels the Green Lantern ring. There's emotions that power all these other rings, but will isn't an emotion. Will is the ability to essentially control your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And project them forward into the world. And domination would literally be the inverse, right? It would be the ability to suppress someone else's emotions, to prevent them from doing what they want to do and making them do what you want them to do. So how would that affect a Death Knight who's literally a shambling corpse who's only alive because somebody else wants them to be? And they're not alive, but it's only moving, only in this form because someone else wanted them to be. Well, they've lost control of their existence, haven't they? So is the pain caused by that? Is it the pain literally the sense of, you know, I've lost even the ability to die on my own? Even that is gone from me? And why do you need to inflict pain to continue? Why is there a hunger to inflict pain? Like, what are you getting out of it? Are you basically saying to the domination, no, I am still here. I do still matter. I do, the things I do affect others. They change the world. I am here. I don't know. I have no idea if that's what it is. But it does interest me that we, you know, the Primus was making it for something. We know that Maldraxxus is all about, you know, fighting ideologies. It's all about these various houses going to war with each other constantly. And nobody wins in Maldraxxus. That's something you really have to think about. There's no victory in Maldraxxus. Nobody wins because it's eternal. It's an eternal conflict. You don't win an eternal conflict. If it has a victor, then it's over. And that's not how Maldraxxus is set up to be. Maldraxxus is set up to be like this forever. So that's worth thinking about when it comes to the Death Knights and the pain that they feel and how it might go into domination magic. Because Death Knights, in addition to all the other things, Death Knights could last forever. Or at least they could last forever as long as there's somebody to hurt. And that's what kind of horrible fight is that? Imagine that. Once you get done, like in a way, Azeroth is the best possible place for them. Because anywhere else in the cosmos, once you got done hurting all the things that maybe deserved it, what do you do now? You know, it's not like, okay, I still have this eternal need to put pain and suffering out there, but there's nobody who deserves it anymore. But on Azeroth, you're never going to run into that problem because there will always be something. Always. If all the other threats on Azeroth stopped tomorrow, new ones would literally just show up. So that's worth considering too. Like, this is, if you think of this as a way to make a disposable weapon, it's not, because the disposable weapon is never going away. So that's my take on it. That's what I'm thinking about, but I don't have an answer. Like, I think you could play your Death Knight as dealing with it however you wanted to, even if they didn't say, if they said tomorrow, nope, Death Knights still feel all that. You could still play your Death Knight however you want to.
Oh, for sure.
They don't have to be like that. You can absolutely do like a full on as grim dark as you want, you know, like my life is miserable pile of secrets type thing. You know, you could totally Castlevania this. But you don't have to. You could also do, like, you know, the undead version of Friendship is Magic. If that's what you want to do, you absolutely can. Just remember that, you know, some of the happiest people you're ever going to meet, some of the funniest people who've ever lived were in horrible pain. That's why they were funny, because they didn't want anyone else to feel that way. Like, there's a lot of depressed comedians. So your Death Knight can crack as wise as you want. They could tell a lot of jokes. That's basically all I got.
All right, well, then I guess we're going to go ahead and move on to the next one, and this one comes from our friend Lord Soth. Well-met watchers of Frozen Weather, it is I,
Lord... I gotta say, speaking of Death Knights, Lord Soth, really? Come on, man. We both play Dragonlance. We know. We know. Anyway, go on.
Investigating the mysteries of the world known as Sanctuary. We know that originally there was only Anu, who then split themselves in two. Upon those dying, they further fractured, Tathamet splitting into the seven evils. Why is it then that despite our numerous slayings of Diablo, he does not fracture further, but instead returns to life in the Hells? What has caused this fracture into smaller and lesser forms to cease with the evils, if we know? If we don't know, it would be very intrigued to hear your theories. Now, I'm sure Matt has opinions on this, and I'm just going to kind of let him go.
Okay, well, first off, we don't know. It's never been said when they die, they don't turn into like six more guys. But I mean, we have seen that they don't exist in the same way that Tathamet and the Diamond Warrior form of Anu did.
Mm-hmm.
For starters, they have children. So they have fractured into smaller pieces by reproducing. Whereas previously they sort of reproduced by being killed and then splitting up into little things. Like Tathamet had seven heads. Those seven heads became the seven evil. But then the seven evil started having offspring. And it's also it's possible that the various creatures in the Hells are also spawned out of Tathamet's corpse, because it's described as wriggling with like death and maggots and so forth. So other lesser demons may also have come from Tathamet, and then they started combining with other things. And also, the Diamond Warrior Anu doesn't split into anybody else. Mm-hmm. He doesn't become the archangels are not like fragments of Tathamet. Of Anu, the Diamond Warrior's spine is the Crystal Arch, and the Crystal Arch radiates vibrations and radiance that creates archangels, but it's not splitting them off from itself. They're not like buddings. So it's interesting to consider this, that evil and good have different ways in the Diablo universe of propagating themselves. I shouldn't say evil and good, because
primal forces.
It's kind of hard. You know, you could say something is good without it being nice. And I guess that's kind of the way the archangels are. They can be concerned with good on a cosmic scale, but willing to do things that are not good on a smaller scale, like say for the entire population of Sanctuary. But in terms of that, I think that's the main thing to take away from this, is that they don't, at this point, for whatever reason, they've started combining and recombining. Like you've got, for instance, Mephisto has multiple children, one of whom is Lilith. Lilith is the daughter of Mephisto. We don't know if he just butted her off. We don't know if there's some other demon out there somewhere that he had her with, or her brother Lucian. We don't know. Like there's nothing out there that tells you who Lilith's mother is, or if Mephisto is both father and mother to her. That's not in the game. There's not in any of the lore. It's not in any of the books.
Yeah, I was going to say, the only real confirmed reproduction that we know of is the, besides humans, is the Nephilim, which were the result of the union between angels and demons. But like, we don't know really ultimately how demons reproduce, other than what we've seen with that. We know that their demons have existed prior to that. So it is an interesting concept to think of, like, we don't have a whole lot of information on it. I'm sorry, I don't mean to like jump in there, but like,
no, that is a good point. I mean, there's some, I don't want to say implication, but there's some inference that you can make that they come from Tathamet's corpse itself, because mm-hmm. Tathamet's corpse itself is the Burning Hells, and all the realms in the Burning Hells are part of Tathamet. They are.
And the same argument can be made though with angels, because of the way that the spine, right?
Yeah, we know the angels come from the Crystal Spire. We know that if you kill an angel, their essence goes back to the Crystal Spire. A new angel will be created, but it's not the same angel. It doesn't. Nothing of the life experience.
I think that's the interesting part to me, though, right? Like that, I think, is really intriguing. Where demons in this particular case, the major demons that we've seen, stay the same, and theoretically, like we're going to see Andariel and Diablo 4, I believe, confirmed, right?
Andariel and Duriel.
Andariel. So, like, they maintain a level of presence of self, one could presume, but the demons seem to be able to do that. Why is that? Why is it that demons can do that, but it seems like the reproduction of angels, or at least just in general, angels being reborn in that cycle, aren't?
I will point out that the difference is that we haven't seen any angels except for one die on the mortal realm.
Tyriel, correct?
Yeah, and Tyriel reformed with his personality intact when he died on the material realm. Mm-hmm. And that's where all the demons we're talking about we've seen die.
Not true, right?
Because the ones that died in the Soul Stone only died in the Soul Stone. Remember that the Soul Stones were all set up to, upon their destruction, be sent to the Black Soul Stone. So when the Soul Stones were destroyed, theoretically destroying that demon, what actually happened was their spirit was sucked into the Black Soul Stone.
And that's where Diablo's essence went after we defeated them in the Crystal Spires, right?
No, they turned back into the Black Soul Stone.
Okay.
They were the Black Soul Stone the whole time. Like when you see the Diablo in Lea, that's the Black Soul Stone. Cause when you see him fall off of the Crystal Spires, he turns back into it. And they collect it. And the angels are like, what do we do with this? And that's why Tyriel recreated the Haradrim in the first place, was to put the Black Soul Stone somewhere where nobody could find it, but to get it the heck out of heaven because it was messing the place up. And when they did that, that's when Malthiel showed up to get it. So it was still at no point did their spirits go where they would have gone when they were destroyed on another plane of existence. But we know that in the Wrath short, that Imperius snaps and kills Diablo, so that Diablo taunts him into doing it, so they can't like take him somewhere and use the angelic version of torture to get anything out of him, which is what they intended to do. They intended to capture him and bind him somewhere where he couldn't be released. So that's the only time we've seen a demon die in another plane of existence and been told that he came back and he did it on purpose to come back. But we also know that unlike angels, demons have their own pocket realms. That's where they go when they die. They go to their pocket realms.
Their subdivision of whatever the hells are, right?
That's even if you play Diablo Immortal, it actually happens. Like, if you beat Scorn at the end, it's pretty obvious that Diablo himself is somehow infused into that realm and speaks to you after you beat Scorn. So there's a lot of the relation between the demons and the angels. But there's a lot to that relationship that I think is basically inverse symmetrical. Like, every place where the demons are static, angels are fluid. Where the demons are chaotic, angels are stable. They're like, it's like, have you ever heard of the technique they came up with for making sound muffle, where they don't try to hide the sound that they don't want you to hear. They make an exactly inverted sound wave to try and cancel out the troughs. And it can be done with a computer, but it's extremely difficult to do because you have to have exact sound, performance. You have to have the sound projected out at the exact place and exact time, so it hits exactly when the other sound wave hits, so it will cancel it out. I feel like that's what angels and demons are, but in a metaphysical sense. And that's why when the Nephilim were created, they have so much power, because they cancel out the division of Anu and Tathamet and go back to the primordial Anu. And the primordial Anu could do anything because it was everything. And that's where their power comes from. It doesn't come from the same, for lack of a better word, biased sources as angels and demons. Angels and demons are the descendants of these two primordial forces. But those two primordial forces used to be one being. And I think that that's a big part of why angels and demons are so different, because they very deliberately were the result of a difference. The original primordial Anu looked into itself and saw, hey, I have the potential to do all these things and all these things. I only want to do these things. So I'm going to rip out the potential to do everything else and get rid of it. But humans and the Nephilim that we descend from have that potential. We can do good or evil. We can do chaotic or orderly. We can do anything. It can be conceived of and done. Even when angels turn corrupt, they're orderly about it.
Mm-hmm.
Even when demons try and be good, they're chaotic about it. Because there is one in the lore who is actually trying not to kill people. It is interesting to think about. I think you're right in that there's an inverse struggle here where, like, the demons retain who they are. But I think the demons retain who they are because that's a selfish thing to do. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, it makes sense, right? Like
you have a stronger sense of self when you are selfish. There's a reason that narcissists can weather almost anything, because they have an unshaking conviction in their own superiority, and that's every demon.
I mean, very true. I mean, you know way more about Diablo than I do, so I'm very happy to get your take on it. But it is an interesting inverse relationship, and I think you might be onto something with that whole the selfish versus the selfless, and the angels being orderly and adhering to this is the way the process works. And just kind of do it. Cause even like Malfiel, like when he decided to go against the natural order of things, he really kind of was very orderly about it. Wasn't he? He was systematic in what he did.
You can even argue he didn't decide to go against the natural order of things, because death is a part of the natural order of things.
True. He just decided to do it at a grand scale.
Oh, it's like he basically, for angels, death is a hard thing to understand, because even when they die, they know they won't die. The thing that is them will continue. They just won't remember any of it. The thing that comes out of the Crystal Arch will still, it'll be like wisdom. So, eventually there will be a new angel of wisdom out there. That angel of wisdom won't be Malfiel, though. So it's like they have a reincarnation cycle, but they still believe in it. that it is the way things are supposed to be. But human death is not something they understand. There are plenty of mortal creatures in the universe. The way they die isn't the way angels die. It isn't the way demons die. So yeah, I think it's fascinating to see what Malfiel became. And the fact that you only beat him by basically doing the same thing, by accepting the natural order of things and letting it, you know, letting your mortality be the biggest part of you. The Nephilim beats Malfiel not with power, but with understanding of that power. And it is really, there's a lot to this I'd love to see get explored more. I don't know that we're going to get that in Diablo 4. I have no idea what Diablo 4 is going to be about. I'm actually kind of happy about that. Looking forward to what they're going to do with Lilith and what her role is going to be. Is she going to just be the big bad, or is she got more going on than that? Because she always has kind of had more going on. But at the same time, she very much wants to win the Eternal Conflict, which is, we talked before about that. You know, like if it ends, it's not an Eternal Conflict. You know, in order for it to be an Eternal Conflict, it has to be eternal. She wants it not to be eternal. She wants to basically, Malfiel at his heart wanted everything to go exactly the way it's supposed to go. And that meant killing all humans because they have demonic taint and aren't supposed to exist. Lilith doesn't want anything to go the way it's supposed to go. She's thrilled that humans exist because they have demonic taint and angelic taint, and she can use them to win and to basically upend the apple cart of existence. The thing that Malfiel in his heart wants to maintain at all costs, even if it means blowing Sanctuary up, she wants to upend at all costs. There's a fascinating difference here that I would love to see more of.
Agreed. And hopefully we'll get a little bit more of that when Diablo 4 starts coming closer to release, because I really want to know what the whole deal is. We'll get there, though. But I'm going to move on to the next question, which is from Roxy. It is I, your friend Roxy, Goblin Shaman, and I am catching up on Lorewatch. I heard Roxy make a passive comment about how being good bargainers makes a goblin really good shaman. I started playing in late Kata and have mained a goblin shaman since Warlords of Draenor. My understanding is when goblin shaman were first announced, there was quite a bit of pushback that they shouldn't be allowed to be shaman. I want to know your original reactions to the reveal of goblin shaman and what lore either justifies it or doesn't. Where Matt has strong feelings about Diablo stuff, I have strong feelings about shaman stuff. Honestly, I was pretty pleased when goblins were announced initially, because it further proved the idea that anybody in any culture could be a shaman. Because in the grand scheme of things, shaman are one of the more, I don't want to say less orderly of the esoteric groups, but they tend to be a little more individualistic, while druids all sort of have their own kind of like focus that they go through. And it is culturally focused. They're probably the closest to shaman in that regard, but the way that a Tuskar shaman celebrates shamanism and worships the ancestors and does its thing and its relationship with the ancestors and the elemental spirits is much different than the way the Draenei look at it. And it's much more different than the way the Volpera look at it. But like the idea of goblins being able to do it makes a certain amount of sense. Elementals on Azeroth in general tend to have a very, depending on when you catch them, they're not necessarily immediately going to murder you. Some of them will talk with you, and it becomes a very transactional thing, and it always has been. It's always been sort of described as that. A traditional shaman, not a dark shaman, makes bargains with the spirits of the elements. It looks for a sort of symbiotic relationship with them. What can I do to help you, and what can you do to help me? And that's very much a goblin sort of wheelhouse is, I'm going to cut a deal. Right now, generally speaking, we tend to look at goblins as trying to look out more for themselves, but their entire society is based off of making deals and brokering deals and exchanging currency. I believe at one point, Matt and I referred to them as like the Ferengi of the Warcraft universe, and it's sort of accurate, right? Like, go back and watch some old episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and you go get the glimpse of the Ferengi homeworld and their government. Like, you go to a government building. You want to use a chair? You got to deposit a couple strips of latinum. Goblins, you want to go to the party? You got to pay a certain amount to have a seat or a drink or whatever the case is, there is nothing that is free. Everything is transactional. And part of the beauty of that is that it's very simplistic and very easy when you're dealing with them, because you know that at the end of the day, you don't have to convince them to do something. You just have to pay them, or you have to come to an agreement. It's not like, do this out of the kindness of your heart. And that works sort of for the elements, right? Because they want something out of us. And a lot of times you'll see like conversations with Thrall and the Elements, or a lot of the other shaman and the elements, you know, bartering, well, this will be good because of this, and this will be good to this. Goblins are very point blank. No, I would need you to do this. I will do this for you. Equal exchange. Let's go. And it makes a lot of sense. And I was always okay with this. And I know some people weren't on board with it, but I think it's good. And Volpera are very much in that same wheelhouse. And I didn't see nearly the backlash to Volpera shaman that I did the original goblin shaman. And Volpera are very much the same way. They're nomad merchants, right? That's their whole deal. They have a very transactional relationship with things as well. And even when you're like doing their quests, it's very obvious once they're freed that that's kind of where they rest. But like, it's the same thing. So I was always okay with this. I was always very happy with it. And as things went on further and further, it made more sense. Like the goblin totems being mechanical creations fits, because that's how they would view the elements. Fire is a fuel, right? So why would you have something else like that? Look at dwarf shaman. Dwarf shaman have essentially a totemic relationship that represents how their clan culture is. It's the crafting hammer with the feathers and all that other stuff, and it's really, really good. The Draenei one are made of crystal because they tend to think of everything in forms of crystal, because that's what the foundation of their society was built on. The Tuskar, I think, are carved in bone when you do actually see the semblance of Tuskar shaman, which fits with their, you know, sort of like fishing lifestyle. Like that's a thing that fits. So like having goblins fill that role and having them be transactional and having them be mechanically inclined, I think fits perfectly. And I think it always has fit. So did you have any initial reaction when they were announced, Matt?
I mean, I was playing mostly Alliance when the announcement came, and I only switched to Horde after. I wasn't strongly invested in goblins. I don't think I've ever really played one past like level, just the starting levels, you know, just so you get to see the starting experience. I don't have a big thing for them, but I didn't think there's, I could make a case for literally any race in Warcraft being a shaman.
Yeah. They all said
it would take no effort at all. It doesn't. And the thing is you have to like think about what you mean by transactional, because you can do this the approach can be in a lot of different ways. It can be the goblin approach is nakedly mercantile. It's literally quid pro quo. I do for you, you do for me. It's exactly like if you went to a mafia don,
yep.
You know, as long as you execute what you promised, they execute what they promised. For orcs, clearly it is not like that. Orcs like to build a relationship. For orcs, it's like the spirit of this, the spirit of that. My ancestors, this lake we live near, the forest itself, the fire we're going to use to burn our enemies. Like they like to have a relationship. But that's still, in the end, like a friendship is give and take. It's not, you would never call your relationship transactional, but if you're always coming, if your friend calls you and says, hey, I need you to come do X, and they're always doing that, and they never come when you call them, like, hey, yeah, man, I need some help. My truck's broken down and I got to get to work. And they're like, I can't help you. And that's all they ever do. You'll stop being friends with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Because while friendship isn't a mercantile exchange, it does require give and take. There's a back and forth. And that's the case with the elements. The elements don't necessarily require you to literally say, do X for me and I'll do Y for you.
There's a lot more nuance to it for most races.
But they'll totally go with that because it's super, you know, as Joe is pointing out, it's easy. It's the simplest way to relate to these mortal beings. I don't have to understand them. I don't have to care about them, but they'll get rid of that like logging camp over there that I hate. And I will, you know, give them the ability to, get into the cave of the water monster that they want to kill. Totally quid pro quo. But with the orc approach, it'd be more like, I see that your area here is getting despoiled by loggers, so I went and killed them for you. Hope you don't mind. And, you know, while we're at it, I also made sure that this stream wasn't polluted. Oh, that was really nice of you, mortal. What's going on? Oh, I could just use a favor. If you don't mind, could you get me down into the cave to kill the water monster? Yeah, that makes sense. The water monster's also poisoning my water. Sure, yeah, all right. It's still an exchange, but it's not, you know, for the orc, they don't want it to be as like a, you know, I'm buying you. That would be insulting to the orc personality. They want it to be a relationship. Torin, it's even more so. For Torin, it's about, hey, I am also a creature of earth and air and fire and water. Like, I get it. You know, I have a part of that in me. Because the earth is literally the ground beneath my feet is my mom. So we can, you know, I can totally help you with your thing and you can help me with my thing. Like, because we're like brothers. And the element's like, I guess that kind of makes sense. Sure, all right. And it's, then you look at the way the Draenei do it. And Joe made a really good point here. The Draenei view it completely differently. The Draenei view everything as part ultimately of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
It's all ultimately connected. What I do for you is what I do for me. And Draenei didn't have shaman until they had Broken. And the Broken were the ones who came to them and said, look, you've never really considered this, but you can't just be good and hope everything works out. You have to be active. You have to be doing things to benefit the world around you. And by benefiting the world around you, you benefit yourself. And that perspective was accepted. Because Velen recognized the truth in it. He recognized that his people were reacting to the horrors they'd gone through in a really negative way. And they were basically persecuting the Broken, and they were exiling them and not treating them like part of the universe. But with the help of Farseer Nubundu and other Broken shaman, the Draenei began to learn how to incorporate shamanism into their worldview. And for them, it isn't. For them, I'd say it's simultaneously the most and the least transactional, because what you do for someone else is what you do for you. So if you want something from the elements, well, you have to help them, because they're by helping them, you're helping yourself either way. And therefore, from the elements' perspective, if the Draenei come to you with that person, with that idea, and you accept it, okay, then yeah, I'll do something for you because you did something for me and you did something for us. You know what I mean? That's every group has a different way of looking at it. The Kul'tirans have taught me that it can be as simple as just respect, because the Kul'tirans don't really do transactions with the spirits that they use their shamanism on. I feel in a way, the Kul'tirans don't actually have shaman as such, do they? I can't even remember anymore. Okay. Then a Kul'tiran shaman isn't, it's about respect. It's about treating the world around you like something you respect. You respect its power. You don't just come to it and tell it what to do. You ask. And in return, the elements may say, okay, I did that for you. Now what about me? And because you respect them, you give them what they want. You do the thing they want. But of course, there's negotiation in that. And again, in a way, it's like goblins have the cheat code for shamanism, because they don't have to come up with a worldview for it. They already believe that everything is about brokering. Everything is about deal making. Everything is about negotiating. And that's what you have to do to be a shaman. So if anything, it didn't make sense. They didn't already have them.
Mm-hmm.
And if nothing else, you should just view shamanism as something they were always doing and just not talking about it, because why the heck wouldn't it be? But so that's my take on it.
Yeah.
I really don't have any problem with goblin shamans any more than I have problems with goblin anything else. The only class I would think I would just be absolutely, totally, diametrically opposed to would be goblin paladin, because it just doesn't make sense. Because you can't negotiate with the light. You can't go, okay, light, I'll do this for you, and you do this for me. The light's like, no, I want you to be a channel that I can pass myself through and affect my world in the world. And I get the ability to be a channel from which I pass through and affect my will upon the world. Do you actually have a will? Not really. what are we doing here? Like, I don't think it would be, I think it would be like almost antithetical to a goblin's mind. Like, you'd almost have to be the nuttiest goblin in existence to be okay with this. Like, you're going to get used by a cosmic force that in no way, shape, or form is going to explain what it's doing or even care what you think about it. Okay. Like, it just doesn't really feel very goblin-y. The goblins have priests, though, so they do shadow priests. So
I was just going to say, there are in fact, goblin priests. So there is a possibility. Depends. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's the only one I would even balk at. But I would always feel like just letting everybody play whatever they want trumps any game lore stuff.
I would agree with that. All right, but we're going to move on to our next one. This one comes from Tillman. As Odin does not like the creation and being of the dragon aspects, do you think he will get that we will get to fight Odin in Dragonflight? And why, how do you think we will fight him? As a warrior myself, I'd love for this to happen. My thoughts, if we do, is we beat him into accepting the Dragonflights and maybe a reason for unrevealed plan of tears for the dragon aspects. There's a lot here, and I wanted to bring this up because I know Matt has all the love in the world for Odin. He is the best Pokemon master. Matt and I speculated, and I think it was on Lore Watch, it might have been on the regular show, that we're probably not seeing the last of Odin. We will see him again, and this expansion would be a good excuse to see him again. One, Helia popping up last expansion and kind of or in Shadowlands and sort of being unresolved is a thing that's still out there. But before that, in Battle for Azeroth, we know that he went back to Ulduar and he was there when Mimran hung up the phone on us when we were trying to connect all the Titan facilities to reoriginate good old friendly N'Zoth, as Mitch would put him, just a friendly tentacle lord. We're probably going to see him again, if nothing else, because the Dragonflights are prominent again, and he was very vocally opposed to them, it would make sense. Now, what that looks like, I don't know. And it might be a fight with Odin. It might be something where he shows up and tries to usurp the power that turned, because we talked about there's a possibility of us reigniting the dragon aspects, right? Like bringing them back to prominence. We don't have anything that qualifies that. We're just speculating that that's the thing that
actually, spoilers, but we do actually have something that qualifies that.
Oh,
And again, spoilers. If you are listening to this, you might want to jump ahead a couple minutes because this is spoilers. In one of the dungeons, the Eldamon dungeon, when you are going there because Alex Straza wants you to go and find the lost, basically diary of Tyr.
Disc
of Morgana, that's Tyr's. And the reason she's sending you to do that is because she thinks it has the key to restoring the power of the Dragonflights, specifically to recreate the aspects.
And so we don't know if it actually does or not yet, right?
We don't know if it actually does or not, but we know that that's one of the things they're doing. And we know the Infinite Dragonflight is trying to stop them. And it's kind of like, I've said the other day that like, if you ask somebody a question and they tell you, you should really ask someone else, like for some reason, that's kind of like, it's not a no. If the answer was a no, they just say no. They're saying you should talk to somebody else. That means there's some complication to this answer. The fact that the Infinite Dragonflight is there trying to stop them from doing it is a pretty big, why would they be trying to stop it if it wouldn't work? You know where I'm going with this? They see the future and they're coming to stop you from doing something. That means they think it'll work.
Fair.
You know, so I'm not, again, there is no direct evidence. This is an inference based on some actual in-game lore. And I think at this point we should move on so people jumping in won't hear it.
But I
definitely think that it is going to be more for Odin to do.
Yeah. And I mean, we're going to interact with him in some place. And if it is us finally fighting him, we kind of fought him in the trial, right? Like we did that whole thing in the dungeon.
Yeah, he tested us yet again.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, this time I don't think it'll be a test. I think it's just going to be us opening a can of whoop on him. But I would not be surprised. He is going to show up again.
I definitely think that because we know Helia has so ultimately escaped, she was banished from the Shadowlands by the Primus, but she's not trapped.
That's a good thing for her. She's not trapped in the Shadowlands anymore.
Yeah. So she could be back in her realm, which wasn't in the Shadowlands. Remember, it was like adjacent to them, but it wasn't in them. Or she could be in the mortal realm. You know, she was banished. Remember, she was banished from it. But originally, before she was murdered, she was like just another Titan forged living on Azeroth. That was her. She had a life there before.
And we know that her Kvaldir were trying to summon her back to the plane, right? Like they were trying to bring her back. You come across that multiple times where like,
I think in Battle for Azeroth, they straight up tell you they like you, yeah. you bring the token of Helyev that you get on one of the island expeditions, and they're like, "Do you think she's dead?" Like, no, she's death. She can't die.
But I remember specifically the very first time we met her when we were dealing with all of the Legion stuff, when we're dealing with all of.
She was being summoned onto the planet.
She was being summoned onto the planet. Yep.
And now, for all we know, she's here. She could be on the ocean somewhere, underwater, messing around with the Naga, because, you know, she doesn't like the Naga. She could even have resumed her mortal form and be living on Azeroth as a mortal being.
Like, oh, man, could you imagine her and Queen Azshara going at it?
It would be interesting. I think that Azshara would have a lot of advantages in this, but Helya does have some of her own to you know. While Azshara is probably the more powerful magician of the two, Helya has a much more understanding of planar relationships.
True.
And also more connections. Like, she's shown that she has a lot of connections. So, I don't know. I do think it would be interesting. I honestly find myself wondering if we're going to see Helya pop up in some future Forsaken quests.
Because they would make
an extremely good power block, especially now that Sylvanas, who she made a deal with, is no longer in the picture. You know, we know that Helya's deal with Sylvanas was related to the whole jailer thing. Now that the jailer's gone and Helya can do her own plans completely free of any kind of worrying about that, if anything, she could become an even bigger menace.
Well, yeah, this is the first time she's been free. She's not beholden to anybody. She's not beholden to Odin, who forced her to become the experimental child. She's not beholden to the jailer, who's been completely removed. Like you've pointed out, Sylvanas has got her own thing. She's busy dealing with the Maw and cleaning up that whole mess. So, like, there's nobody left for her to be beholden to. She's completely on her own. She's a wild card at that point. Like, we don't know what her plans were, because ever from the beginning, like, first she tried doing the right thing and helping out the Titans, and then Odin did what he did, and that sent her down this path. Then she made the deal with the jailer.
Yeah, and keep in mind, Helya's death came about because of the Dragonflight. Odin killed her because she wouldn't let him use the process to bring souls back and create his Stormforged, which he was doing because he didn't like the Dragonflights and wanted a Titanforged solution to the problem. And he only knew how to do that because he forced Helya to open a portal into the Shadowlands and make the deal that he did with Muzala to trade his eye for power.
And not only that, but there's some other complications. Sorry, real quick. Who created the elemental prisons?
She did.
And what are we dealing with in the next expansion? We know for a fact they've announced this.
Freed elemental beings.
Huh.
The elemental primals and half elemental giants. What sounds like a half elemental giant? Could that be some kind of Rykul? Like an iron or earth Rykul that's somehow infused with the power of the elements instead of the Titans? The whole deal of in Dragonflight, the whole deal of the primals is they think the Titans and the Titans' influence is a corruption, that it's opposed to what Azeroth should be, that it's being imposed on the world, which sounds fairly, you know, there's certain resemblances to things like, you know, the old gods and what drove Loken nuts. And Loken is the one who freed her from Odin's control in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And Loken was later killed by mortals, which means that since he was dead, he could very well have ended up in the Shadowlands and Helya was there. So there's all sorts of ways this could play out. But I definitely think we might see Helya in this expansion. We might see Odin in this expansion, especially if we see Helya. She might be manipulating him because she does know him, and he's refused to learn a dang thing in like the last however many thousands of years. So yeah, there's a lot. I don't know that we'll see. We might not see either of them. And that would be unfortunate, but it's what might happen. But there certainly is possibility for both of them to show up.
I would be surprised if we don't see them. All right, but I think that's going to answer that one, hopefully. We're going to move on to our last question here for the day. This one comes from Yerick. You mentioned so much about Dragonflight having connections to the power of the dragon aspects. My issue is that when they were given the powers of the aspects in Dragonflight, in Dragonblight, not on the Dragon Isles. How do you think Dawn of the Aspects will be retconned, decanonized, or otherwise addressed to make things fit into the current story?
Well, technically speaking, Malagos got his powers as an aspect in the Eye of Eternity.
Correct.
It doesn't say, there's nothing that says they can't get their powers from a different location.
Or where the process was born.
Yeah. Yeah, we just know that they were, you know, Tyr gave them their powers, and apparently in the Dragonflight and the Dragonblight, but it's very possible that that doesn't mean that the power from it didn't come from the Dragon Isles in the first place. Maybe that's why they went to the Dragon Isles.
Also,
because that's where everything Tyr built was. And they, you know, they just, okay, we, Dragonblight's cool. We've been here for a while. We certainly like leaving our dead people here, but let's go live in that other place, the magical islands with all the cool dragon stuff. Let's go do that. I mean, I don't know. I don't, but it doesn't have to be as, it doesn't have to be, you know, Dragonblight or bust.
Also, don't forget that the Dragonblight was definitely connected to extraplanar pockets of reality too, right? Like, we know that going below them opened up portals into their sanctums. We don't know if there were other ways of connection to those sanctums. It is implied that there might have been, especially when you're doing some of the early quests in Dragonflight, that things might be a little more connected, or dragons might have had a little more maneuverability than we expected, or maybe have predicted prior, the besides just flying places as dragons. We know that Malagos can be in multiple places at once.
Yeah, and for that matter, we don't actually know where those sanctums are.
Exactly. Where
is the Ruby Sanctum? Where is the Obsidian Sanctum? Were they in fact going back to the Dragon Isles and they just couldn't physically find it? Like, they could only get there and get back via the portal? I don't know. But they might not have been. They might have been out pockets into another reality. Heck, maybe they're out pockets into another reality that used to be accessible from the Dragon Isles, but then weren't. I think it's fair to say that we know the Dragon Isles were always isles. Like, even when Kalimdor was one continent,
they were always secluded and sectioned off, right?
They were always off in their own little place. And that makes sense, because it would have been someplace that they want, that they would have been, you know, completely free of interference. Like, keep in mind that they were doing the stuff they were doing for a very long time before the Sundering ever happened.
The other thing that I think is really important here too is, I don't think anything needs to be retconned or decanonized at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
For this work, right? Like, think of the Dragon Isles as the research center for dragons. If you really need to make a comparison for it, right? We know that Tyr definitely was there at some point. We know that there were watchers there, definitely created in it, maybe in Tyr's image. There's a Titan facility. We know that Titan facilities are often used for experimentation. We know this for a fact. When we go and meet Mother for the first time, what is she doing? She's experimenting. What happened with the watchers there? They accidentally created an old god because they didn't know what they were messing with and experimented a little too hard. But there's nothing that says...
Hold on.
Go ahead.
This may be what you were going to say anyway.
Probably.
And if it is, I apologize. But
No.
We also know that Tyr
experimented
without knowing what he was doing, and he created Galakrond. And that's why we have aspects in the first place, because they bound together, you know, they came together to stop Galakrond. But we also know that dragons aren't originally from Azeroth. Dragons are from the elemental planes.
Mm-hmm.
They are elemental beings who became essentially kind of curse of fleshed. The drakes that we know, the proto drakes, are kind of like curse of fleshed versions of elemental drakes, like the stone drakes you see in Deepholm. Those beings existed before the planes themselves were created. There used to be just like kind of an elemental plane, and they got sectioned off when I can't remember his name, Raden, Master Ra. When Master Ra and Helya came together to make the elemental planes using the power of the Fist of Raden, they sectioned them off so that the fire elementals, you know, but there was originally this plane where they all came together, and it seems like this plane exists for every world. Like, Draenor, which had its own elementals and its own elemental plane, doesn't have segmented elemental planes. It just has all the elements together. And because there's no Titan soul drinking up all the spirit energy, those elementals don't fight because there's enough for everybody. And they're just super like chill with each other. But the Azerothian ones weren't. And that's why they had to be segmented off. So what if something before Odin got involved in all of it, maybe Tyr was bringing elemental forms forward into Azeroth from the plane of the elemental planes to create dragons in the first place. What if dragons are themselves a creation of Titan experimentation?
Mm-hmm.
And what if that's why Odin was opposed to it? Was because he knew these things are not like us. We're Titan forged. The Titans made us. These things are just, you know, some experiment. Can't just give them like all this power and make them in charge. And yet it's the Titans themselves who gave it to them, not Tyr. Tyr opens a portal, but the Titans are the ones who actually empower the Aspects. Like, when Norsdormu gets his powers, Amon-Thul directly talks to him.
Yep.
And it's the same for all of them.
Alexstrasza with A&R. And like,
yeah. So direct it might links. Be that it might be that Tyr had a more important job than we realize. That whilst Odin was the prime designate for Azeroth, Tyr's job was this.
Tyr's job always struck me as sort of the, he was in charge of creating defenses. That was never really fell under what I thought the prime designate would do, right? The prime designate was, to me, always sort of like, I don't want to say a pencil pusher, but like they were supposed to coordinate the efforts of the other ones, right?
Yeah, think of him as a project manager.
I was just going to say that. They are literally the prime designate is the project manager of the operation. But Tyr always struck me as the one that was in charge of trying to create defenses.
He's security.
For Azeroth. He's security.
Report to the project manager.
Exactly.
Security reports to its own thing. And the Titans are the ones up top. There'd be a head of the security department who would report to the board, essentially, or the CEO or what have you, whatever the organization for the organization is, but he'd report up. He isn't going to report to some project manager, even if the project manager is the project manager for the whole world. And you see that in their relationship. Tyr doesn't take orders from Odin at any point.
Nope.
And when people come to him with a problem, Tyr deals with it directly.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't wait for Odin's opinion. So I think
it's also why Loken needed to go after him, right? Because if he's in charge of the defenses and you have this sort of like pocket army of gibbering flesh things, you send them after the thing that's going to be in charge of defending the world. And that's what that is, right?
Yeah, he has to get Tyr out of the way before he can rule safely. If Tyr is still here, then the second he's like, now we're going to let the old gods out of there, nope.
No,
we ain't doing that. Absolutely not.
The other thing that I think is going to be interesting is the tomb of Tyr. There is no body for Tyr in there, right? There's no remains or anything like that. And we've seen Titan Watchers. We've corporeally like tangled with them in meat space. Like we've done that. We've never found Tyr's body. We don't know what happened to him. And there's a whole other tinfoil hat thing that Tyr actually didn't die, that like he's just hiding and biding his time or licking his wounds over the course of millennia, whatever the case is. But like,
well, here's the thing. We know that one Titan Watcher supposedly died.
We do.
And his children rebuilt him and he's still around. Mimiron.
Yep.
So the essence of a Titan Watcher, of a Watcher, we don't know about all Titan Forge, but the essence of a Titan Watcher seems to be something that can be brought back. It can almost be given a new form.
Almost like they could have possibly gone back and maybe taken his remains, found his spark, and maybe built him a new shell.
Yeah. I mean, don't make it too Transformer-y, dude. We don't have the time to do an entire Transformer stuff. But in all sincerity, like seriously, think about this. If Mimiron could be given a new body, because they didn't just put him back in his old body. They built a new one and he's in it and he's a little cracked from the experience, but it's him, you know, he's not cracked because he's inherently flawed. He's cracked because he died and now he's back and he has to deal with that.
I'm going to point this out too. Like a lot of Tyr's followers, they were pretty close with the light. What's the light known for doing? Healing.
Yeah. In fact, Tyr's hand and the whole thing about Tyr hold, all of these things named after Tyr in the Eastern Kingdoms are really central to the Paladin organization.
Mm-hmm.
What is that Paladin organization called again? The Silver Hand. And what was Tyr famous for losing his hand to? Galakrond.
Yep.
And that's why he had a Silver Hand. It's like, there is a lot of possibility here. I don't know that they're going to see it. I don't know if Tyr's going to show up. But even if Tyr is physically dead, like even if his body is dead, there's nothing that says his spirit couldn't either be reborn or hasn't already gone somewhere. Like he might, because here's the thing. When the actual Titans died, that's what they did.
Yeah.
They did the exact same thing. They went out and who did they inhabit? The Titan Watchers on Azeroth.
Do you know what I would really love to see? I'd love to see like part of the story arc be us like, oh, here's Tyr's spirit. We need to go ahead and shove him in his new mech suit And then Odin shows up and tries to stop us. And we finally help with the battle between Tyr and Odin. I would be down for this. Like, helping Tyr put Odin in his place and showing Odin that he's a big hot pile of gas, I'd be A-okay with.
See, honestly, while I would be okay with it, at the same time, I feel like that's too predictable.
Sure.
Like, one of the things I would actually like to see is that if there is an actual honorable side to Odin, like, you know, because he did want to save the world. Like, during Legion, he did want to help, even though he couldn't leave his you know, halls of valor. He wanted to help. Like, to the point where he sent a Valkyr to grab the strongest warrior in the world and bring him up and said, look, you got all my resources. Go save this planet. You know, yes, he made me his Pokemon, and I don't like that. But at the same time, he did want to help, you know? And he didn't have to. It's not like he would have been affected. Azeroth would have died, and he still would have been in his little keep forever. Fine. So I think that I do think we're going to need to slap some sense into him. But I would like it if at the end of the slapping some sense into him, he's like realizes, oh, I've let my ego get in the way here. Because that was the biggest problem he had from the beginning. He and Raden and Tyr were basically equals, and it drove him crazy to the point where Raden left so he didn't have to deal with him. You know, Raden was everyone. There's a reason Raden's name is Master Ra. You know, he's the guy who built the elemental planes.
Yeah.
Like when Helya helped him, absolutely. But it drove Odin crazy to see Helya go off and help this guy. Helya was like his daughter. He adopted her. And here she is off helping Raden do this thing. And Tyr won't listen to him at all. Doesn't defy him, just doesn't listen to him. He gives him an order and he's like, yeah, whatever, and goes off and does whatever he wants. Yeah, I would love to see Odin finally come to terms with the fact that he's been up his own butt this whole time. I just don't want to kill him.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like I said, he did want to help.
Like you said, I'm not saying kill him. I'm just saying, like, you know, smack him around a little bit and like, listen, you already had half your face burned off. You made some poor choices. Maybe we try and reevaluate this, homie.
Or even Tyr be like, you know, Odin, stop this. You know, we have other problems. We have other enemies to fight, blah, blah.
I'd be down with
it. For that matter, it would be lovely if then it turned out Helya was the one, like Helya was behind everything. So, yeah. But the worst part is I as I'm saying this, I know they already have a story and this is probably not it.
No.
But man, I want to see more of this stuff. I would love to see Tyr come back.
I would love to see it, but it really is. I would love to see that confrontation or at least a moment between Tyr and Odin because they never really got to have it, right? Like Tyr got hunted down, did what he did to save everything and set things in motion, especially with the discs under Ganon, right? Like he, go
what
for if it.
That's what it is.
Uh huh.
That's what it is down there. It's not his dictionary his diary. It's him. It's like when he died, Arcadius went into his body and pulled out the Bart holding on to
Matrix
of Leadership. He pulls it out of him and then takes it to Alduar. Because where else is he going to take it?
Oh, you mean Alderman?
Yeah, Alderman. Sorry.
And who's in Alderman? Who's one of the very first Watchers we ever encounter?
Well, besides Ironia, it's Arcadius.
And who traveled with Tyr?
Arcadius and Ironia. Yeah, no, I know that. Yeah,
This is what I'm saying for the folks at home, right? Like, it would make sense that they would also stick around there for so long, not just to protect the discs, but what if there was another reason?
Yeah, well, the discs themselves were the things they stole from Loken, but if they had Tyr's, for lack of a better word, we're going to keep calling it Spark because it works. And we've both watched the Transformers movie a lot of times.
Yeah, way too much.
So Arcadius wouldn't think himself worthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly, like, you know, if he tries to put it in himself when he's already got himself in himself, well, we already know that's going to be too much. So, and Ironeye is not like an actual Watcher like Arcadius was. So yeah, they bring it to Aldemon and just set the place up to guard it, to keep it safe. And the old gods knew that.
Yep.
That's why the Trogs are there, because they corrupted the Earthen.
That's why they maybe created Trogs in the first place.
Trogs are created from Earthen. They're essentially a devolution of the Earthen.
But think about it. The corruption, the ones that the old gods focused on corrupting were Trogs, which are Earthen, which were tied to the deep places.
And which exist also in Earth, in Deep Home.
Which exists in Deep Home.
There's no Earth in there.
When also who, what other dragon aspect, did they go after who was also in charge of guarding the deep places?
Yeah. Good old, Neltharion. I can't say his name. Deathwing. Oh, there we go.
Yeah. But I mean, it seems a little convenient that a lot of their corruption seems to be, and even the looking at our wonderful bug friends, right? Our wonderful Silithid and everything else.
The Akir, the Nerubians.
What do they do?
The Anted. Yeah.
They
dig into the earth.
It can't be a coincidence. Everything seems to be tied to the earth.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, it would make sense there because the old gods are buried in it.
Sure.
You know, that's where they are. If you have a tumor, the tumor is inside your body, you know, and that's what the old gods are, like parasites that have like dug in there. They're in there. And all the Titans did because they were afraid to rip them out. Remember, they didn't understand them. That's why
they sealed them away.
So they locked them up. They turned various Titan facilities into prisons. Both the place that would become Ankaraj and the place that would become Olduwar. They turned them into prisons. They weren't originally prisons. What were they originally? I mean, we know that Olduwar was connected to the entire thing about creating the Well of Eternity, but it obviously had a purpose before that.
And we know that a lot of them happen to be either research stations or in the case of
Titanforge creators.
Like, Titanforge creators or Ungoro, where it's a terraforming experiment. Or
Petri dish.
Yep. Where these facilities had certain key things that they were either doing, but they all seem to be tied back to, I don't want to say healing Azeroth, but there's definitely an aspect of it, and everything seems to tie into that. Because look at Aldir, right? It was a facility trying to figure out how to get rid of Ulgot corruption.
But like, look at the fact that like these facilities tend to be close to each other.
Yep.
Because Aldir is very close to the Zandalar Mountain, which is itself a Titan facility.
Mm-hmm.
We had the big Titan lock on the top of it. And then there's another Titan facility over in Voldoon, the one that has the other lock on it.
Yep.
Meanwhile, if you look at, you just mentioned Ungoro. Ungoro is right next to Ankaraj.
Mm-hmm. Which has multiple facilities within it.
Which is right next to Uldum, which has also got a big Titan facility because that's where the
re-origination.
The re-origination machine is right there. And they're all near each other. So these things were like, was Ungoro being used as essentially a test bed for stuff they were trying to do to like whatever they were doing in Ankaraj before it was Ankaraj? Like, because we don't know what that place was. We don't know what its facility was for.
Because we've only seen it in ruins and we've only seen it post-corruption.
Yeah. Was it Aldoris?
Remember, it would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But we don't know. But it was full of those, you know, it is fascinating to think about this, but we don't ultimately. What we're getting at here is that we got so far off track on is that yes, Odin might show up, and certainly it would be interesting if he did.
And also that raising the dragon aspects does not anywhere else does not decanonize or retcon anything that's already come beforehand.
Absolutely.
So, but I think that's going to do it for us today, folks. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ad-free site experience. Again, if you have questions for this show or any of our shows, be sure to send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify the show that it is for. You can also send those into our various Discord channels. We have one set aside for our Patreon supporters, as well as one for folks that can't support us on Patreon. Again, we understand times are tough, but we do want to thank you for your continued support, because without you, literally none of these shows would exist. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, it would just be me in my basement talking to myself, and we don't need more of that.
Very true. It would be really weird. But with that, folks, we'll see you next week.
Thor Watch!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com code program.